Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first episode in the Leg Upward Inclusion Spotlight, Making the Invisible Visible, with me, Dr. Aparajita Jidigunta. In this inaugural episode, I will be shining the spotlight on a New Leaders Council alumnus. For those who may not know, New Leaders Council is the hub for progressive millennial thought leadership, where they train progressive leaders through a six-month training program called the NLC Institute. I was a fellow in this institute in 2019, and that's how I was exposed to this incredible network and the most amazing people. So I thought it was fitting that my first guest for this entire podcast is a fellow New Leaders Council member, Eric DeSobe. Eric currently works as Director of Talent at Great Public Schools Now. In his role, he creates and manages initiatives that improve LA schools' ability to recruit talented, diverse teachers and leaders, as well as projects that retain them. Prior to this role, he worked at KIPP LA Schools and taught fourth grade in Compton. A 2010 New Leaders Council Los Angeles Fellow, Eric has served as NLC LA Chapter Director since 2011, which included four stints at NLC Institute Co-Director. Originally from Houston, Eric has a deep passion for progressive rock music, Smoothie King, and being the host of The Zag, an NLC LA podcast featuring alums locally and beyond. That's actually how I got into the podcast world, is via Eric's podcast, The Zag, where I was a guest, and Eric became my unofficial podcast mentor as I built this podcast up. So I thought it was very fitting to have Eric as my first guest. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome Eric to the very first episode. Hi, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. You know, so I could go so many directions with this, but what really, really interested me was in terms of, you know, your NLC experience and how you've grown as a progressive. You said you learned so much about what it means to be progressive on housing or mobility or food justice or prison abolition and all of those, just sort of like this overall umbrella of progressivism. So I thought that would be a great place to start. Can you tell me what progressivism means to you?
Yeah, so it was a great experience being an NLC fellow in 2010. And like I said, I've met so many people over the last 9 years, and they've exposed me to issues that were important to them in terms of what it meant to be a progressive. And I think of things like food justice and animal rights, or I think of, like you mentioned, transportation and mobility. Yeah, so I think a lot of what being a progressive means to me is, what is the most consistent way you can design systems that are equitable and fair and aren't tilted and are not rigged in a way that's going to help the same, you know, white male old folks that have been benefiting from a lot of the government systems and systems just in general for all of our lives, and then definitely for the life of this country. So it's been an exciting group to be near and around and a part of for the last almost 10 years now.
Wow, that's incredible. You know, because as this was my first NLC experience at the convention, and I'm a recent fellow, I still have a lot to. I came in thinking I know enough about progressivism and progressive reform, and I'm finding out that I have so much more left to learn. So it is inspiring to hear someone who's been in this space for 10 years to talk about all of the things that you've learned. How did, your NLC experience relate or translate back to your teaching space and your, in the education space?
Oh, so that's a good question. So I guess by the time I did the fellowship, I had retired from classroom teaching. So I finished as a fifth grade teacher in 2008, and I taught for 5 years in all in Compton, but then transitioned to out-of-classroom role. So I worked for a charter school network called KIPP LA, mm-hmm. and was really in charge of recruiting a lot of their teachers, training some teachers, and kind of overseeing their talent. And just in general, NLC just expanded my network beyond education. And a lot of the issues that we know schools that traditionally are under-resourced or in communities that have been denied a lot of the resources that they need, you have to have folks in all sectors approaching that challenged. So whether that's people who are lawyers, people who are doctors, people who are public health, people who are writing policy, people who are elected officials, all those folks have to be working in concert together. And so while I was, you know, tackling the issues of trying to make schools better by ensuring that there were great teachers in front of kids, you know, it was exciting to meet so many different folks through NLC who could help in that cause by making sure that policy in the city was being designed correctly, or that if there were challenges, say, with immigration status, or that there were public health issues, that I now knew people who were working in those fields who I knew shared my progressive values. So it was something that I always thought overlapped really well. I think that's one of the reasons why I stayed around so long. The joke I would usually make is I'd be crazy to leave, because every January there was this infusion of about 20 new folks into my life who just expanded my network and my thinking in so many different ways that what I was doing for my actual job benefited a lot.
Nice. So I'm curious, you know, you brought up some things about like immigration status and those type of things, which I think schools or educational systems that are more on the north side of the country or more inland don't necessarily have to deal with those issues as much. So in that context, what do you feel are the specific issues of equity and inclusion that LA schools face?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, one is definitely funding. Compared to, say, our friends on the East Coast, California's pure pupil funding is really low. And that was intentional. It was by design. In the late 70s, there was an anti-tax revolt led by Republicans, and it put in place something in the state called Prop 13, which essentially capped property tax values in this weird way where, say you bought your house in 1975, and whatever property taxes you were paying at that time were essentially frozen. And so no matter if you're now sitting on a $3 million home that's appreciated in value that much since 1975, you're still paying the same property tax that you were that many years ago. Whereas your neighbor who maybe bought their house 3 years ago is paying a much different and much higher property tax rate. So it's really skewed a lot of the structural pieces that before that Prop 13 passed, California was known as something, as a place with a great public university system that was super affordable. And while schools still had achievement gaps and, you know, race challenges amongst those achievement gaps, it was a lot different than it is now. And so there's just some structural challenges that are first and foremost at the top of everyone's mind when it comes to improving education in LA. I think that's what was driving a lot of what was happening with the teacher strike in January. I think you're seeing a lot of that underlying anxiety about lack of funding in the conversations now that are up and down the state about traditional schools versus charter schools. There's just such an anxiety about there's not enough funds because the state made this decision almost 30, 40 years ago to cap itself in ways that would have been so much smarter to not do. So those are the things that are kind of top of mind structurally. But, you know, like we saw with those the raids in the South, I mean, as the first day of school comes up here in LA and across the state, there's legitimate fear from families that they shouldn't take their kids to drop off at school if there's ICE raids on the first day of school. That's a real fear and a real thought. And so that's top of mind for a lot of folks too. And we're really looking towards the politicians and the elected officials to do all they can to protect kids and families as school starts back up.
Yeah. You know, you brought up two things. The one is the entire charter school system. And the second is what is going on in our, you know, in our nation right now with these ICE raids. And I'd like to tackle both of those right after this short mm-hmm. break. So don't go away. And we're back on Leg Upward Inclusion Spotlight, Making the Invisible Visible. And I'm talking to Eric DeSobe, a 2010 LA New Leaders Council member and also a chapter director. Now, one of the things you mentioned is charter schools. And I kind of chuckled when I saw your answer, you know, in the forum that why everyone hates charter schools all of a sudden. That's something saying that you'd be happy to talk about. So tell me your thoughts on that.
Yeah. And so as somebody who's only taught in a traditional district setting, like I said, I taught in Compton for many years. That's my only experience. I was a Compton unified union dues paying member, and then transitioned to work for a great charter school network, KIPP LA. And there's been a lot of really strong traditional public schools that have opened in LA, and there's been a lot of strong charter schools here in LA. But it's been pretty wild in the last 12 months to see the demonization of the very phrase charter school and the concept of charter schools. And it also was at the heart of the strike, and a lot of the language coming from the union asking for support in the city was around this idea that somehow charters had had or are the reason why traditional schools are underperforming. And it was almost weird because it was hearkening, they were almost trying to have folks hearken back to a time before charters existed in the city, where somehow there was this golden age of education where all kids of color were learning at these incredibly high rates and could read and do math at unbelievable levels. And it just wasn't the case. And so it's been hard to watch the pressure that's been put on the charter sector, which has some things it can improve, sure, just like the traditional sector has. But it's gotten really complicated because you have folks who say they're progressive, you have folks who say they are liberal, but they tend to be white, and they tend to be looking for any excuse to pull choice away from families of color. And it's really worrisome that we may be in a situation based on some of the bills that are in Sacramento where really amazing charter schools will not get their charter renewed or will have to close. And what that will mean for communities of color who had been underserved for literally decades from their neighborhood school have some options now, have some choice, and exercise that choice and should have the right to do so. So it's been kind of wild to watch how the political winds have shifted, how bedfellows have rearranged, and who's on whose side all of a sudden. Hopefully some of it tampers down if and when Trump loses. I think there's been some laziness by folks who are progressive, sort of trying to tie charters directly to Betsy DeVos or to Trump. You know, each charter sector in each state is so radically different. It's not a very nuanced, thoughtful approach to it. Rather, the thought should be, what's going to put kids first? What's going to be the option that gives families of need the chance to choose the school they want? Because you and I both know, when families do have means, they exercise choice in so many different ways. They can move, they can buy a new home, they can get a tutor, they can do all these things to supplement what they might perceive as a weak school. Those options are not present in a lot of the communities in Los Angeles. And so to watch the assault on potentially taking away some of these schools has been really hard.
That's really heartbreaking to hear. And, but, you know, I completely agree with you that those who, you know, those of us who have the choice do things like move away, which is why, you know, my family moved away last year, because my daughter's getting to be school age. And just like you said, with the property taxes and everything, it just really did not make sense for us to be in that space anymore. And so we were able to exercise our right to relocate to a completely different state. How much of all of this do you think, you kind of mentioned like tying it to the Trump administration or Betsy DeVos, but how much of this has been sort of building up in the overall GOP rhetoric for the past like 20, 30 years, in your opinion?
Well, it's hard to say. I think schools are something that can cut across the spectrum pretty frequently. And so, yeah, there have been times where I've been surprised when I would share my education viewpoints who would agree with me. And there are times I'd share that same viewpoint and I'd be surprised about who is not agreeing with me, because on every other issue, I would be aligned with the progressive, and on every other issue, I most often would be not aligned with a conservative person. I think with schools, because everyone's been to a school, everyone has gone through that experience, everyone's opinions are super personal. And when they have kids involved too, their own kids especially, they're going to fight in ways that they might not fight otherwise. And that's good. You should have that engagement, that activity. It's just been kind of wild to see where these things have gone. So I'm not necessarily sure it's a political party timeline that you would trace. I think it's kind of political headwinds that just shift, and one day you're up, one day you're not, and it's very likely things could shift back. I mean, I think some of the work we're trying to do is to get to a place where the success of a school is, are kids learning, Are they really good at reading? Are they really good at math? Are they happy? Are there justice practices there that are not disproportionately impacting students of color? Like all the things we know that make a healthy, vibrant school. Like, are those things front and center rather than, you know, deep, intricate jargon speak about school governance, or is it a charter? Is it an affiliated charter? Is it a magnet? Is it these types of things? Is the school good? It'd be nice to return to those kind of conversations and to really put a lot of the adult energy back into those ideas rather than these kind of high level top down discussions that get you farther and farther away from what is the actual instruction that a kid is receiving and benefiting from in the classroom itself.
That actually makes a lot of sense, you know, to address the students' needs from where they are instead of assuming these needs from like a purely bird's eye view theoretical standpoint from like, you know, an outsider's perspective. So I can definitely see how that would actually be more targeted and more meaningful than these overarching policies that may not touch everybody in the way they're needed to or intended to. I want to ask you when we need to take a short break, but when we come back, I would love to talk to you about what initiatives and projects that you are currently managing and creating from your progressive thought and space in your role right now. So we'll be right back after this short break to talk about that. And we're back on Leg Upward Spotlight Inclusion with Eric DeSobe. So Eric, you are the Director of Talent at Great Public Schools now, currently, right?
Correct.
So what does a Director of Talent at Great Public Schools now do?
So I have a cool job. I get to give away money. It's not my money, sadly, but I'm giving away money basically as a program officer for a foundation. But because of my slightly unique background of having worked as a classroom teacher and then also then worked as somebody who was hiring a lot of teachers or designing programs that were intended to get folks into the teaching profession or to keep folks in the profession, a lot of the things that I fund are around teacher pipeline work and how do you get really diverse, talented folks into the profession and how do you then keep them there, especially teachers who, the phrase we use in the office and in the sector really is an irreplaceable teacher. There are teachers that you know in any building, if you could walk into any school building right now and ask probably the first five teachers or administrators you see, like who are the folks that you can't lose because so much of how the school hums and runs is based on their abilities. It's usually a pretty quick consensus on who those people are. You can't lose those people. So we've tried to, you know, design proposals and projects and things we funded that would encourage a school district or a charter network to really think deeply about how to keep those irreplaceable teachers in the building. And that's given me, I think, a good chance too to live out some of the progressive values. I'll give you a quick example on the retention piece. We worked with a charter school network that really doubled down on the sustainability and health and wellness of the teachers in their network, especially the irreplaceable teachers they didn't want to lose. And so what they were trying to create after they talked to their teachers was basically a comfortable lifestyle that you could start as someone relatively young, say in your early to mid 20s, but then get married, have a family, have kids, and still want to be a classroom teacher. So they hired with some of our funds a health and wellness coordinator, someone who could actually oversee health and wellness activities for teachers. So whether that was yoga classes or physical fitness challenges or nutrition training, they actually hired someone on staff to make sure that their teachers were living their best life that way. And they also put a lot of thought into if their teachers were having kids, and they were, and the majority of their staff were female, what was the environment like when they would come back to work? And so they actually purchased really nice nursing pods for each of their campuses because they were hearing really kind of wild stories of teachers in maintenance closets or like hiding in the back of their classroom with a curtain so they could pump and those kind of things. But that's to me an example of, you know, how do you make the system more equitable, more fair, not so designed by an old white guy to really then capture and keep and support some of the best teaching talent in the city. We can't lose those folks. So it's been fun to have that opportunity to put some of those things into practice and to see over time, longer term, how that was impacting in a positive way teacher retention.
Wow, that's so inspiring to hear. And it actually gave me goosebumps as you were talking about it, because that is an issue that is so deeply personal to me, being, you know, a mother who went through these and other spaces, that it warms my heart to see at least some initiatives happening in terms of young mothers who are also teachers. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about Black male teachers. You know, we heard Devante Spark talk at the National Convention about the severe scarcity of Black male teachers being role models for young Black men in the classroom, and how there doesn't seem to be a pipeline for that. Given your experience, what do you think we need to do to move forward on that aspect of progressive reform?
Yeah, that's something we've thought a lot about. And you know, I'll give you an example through a program that we've funded of what we're trying to do. So we started something called Roots LA. And what it does is it tries to capture and catch college students earlier in their college experience. So this program in particular focuses on rising college seniors. So they haven't graduated yet, and gives them an opportunity to essentially teach summer school and get a lot of really great hands-on basic teacher coaching and instruction. And so what we're able to do is have an opportunity to catch folks earlier. And so people of color is the highest priority in our recruitment process. And so in this most recent summer, we finished with our second cohort. We had about 60 people or so go through it. Almost 90%, wow. Yeah, almost 90% of those folks were people of color. They had ties to LA. So I think it's being really conscious and explicit about catching people as early as possible, and Black males especially, and really seeding the excitement and the importance and the impact of the profession. And especially if you can get folks who are interested in math and STEM and those kind of things too, you're going to see a lot of benefit. And those folks are often snapped up by engineering companies or tech companies. You know, those types of companies recruit everyone super early and try to woo you really hard in college. I want the teaching profession to do that as well. So those are the kind of things that we start to do.
Oh, okay. That's really interesting that, you know, that the pipeline starts senior year of college. And I'm curious to hear how that would tie into the sort of argument, you know, when we talk about intentional inclusion and intentional diversity, and that we have to target certain groups to move past token representation. But on the other hand, from the other side of the spectrum, what I hear a lot of is, well, by doing that, you're excluding people who are already in this space. How would you respond to that as an educator, as a director of talent, and as a white male?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of research that bears some of those things out on the tokenization, or that schools will sometimes steer African-American teachers into roles of discipline rather than in roles of curriculum. And, you know, those things, the more you're conscious of and the more you can design systems that would prevent that, the stronger your school will be and the stronger the system will be. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we're always thinking about is we're putting funds into things that we are trying to support is what ways are we not replicating a lot of the challenges when it comes to who's in the teaching profession and how they're being utilized with their skills in the profession also.
Okay. So we're going to take one last quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how you plan to make the invisible even more visible in your space. So we'll be right back. So, and welcome back. We are chatting with Eric DeSobe on Leg Upward Inclusion Spotlight. And Eric, what I want to ask you is, you know, my whole sort of spiel or, you know, life's work, if you want to call it, is making the invisible visible. And so I'm specifically talking about mental well-being and invisible disabilities, but also visible disabilities. What do you think needs to be done on the education front to increase awareness and representation of those with visible and invisible disabilities?
Ooh, I mean, I think that's a really challenging question. It's a case where you need teachers to have a different level of training than they're receiving. So instructional content, of course, they're getting, but when you think about all the different types of students in a classroom, what ways do they need to be supported? And what you just mentioned, there's a lot that teachers can't see. So I think that the teacher training process can evolve and change. And that happens in the university setting, that happens in a master's degree setting. Those are the kind of things I'd want to see happen.
Okay. And then what about in terms of initiatives for the students to take control of their own mental well-being and to be able to address mental well-being issues without being stigmatized?
So I think it's a case where you really have to be thoughtful, not only in a classroom setting, but then at the school level. Because you think about a student's day, a lot of it is in the classroom, but a lot of it is traveling class to class, going to lunch, what happens at recess, what happens after school. There really has to be a collective effort and a culture built by the school principal and all the teachers together to reduce any sort of stigmas. And a lot of times that's just straight talk, education, giving kids the access to the knowledge so they can better understand who their classmates are. And then also having structures in place when there are challenges that arise, whether it's teasing or bullying, that you have opportunities for students to restore that relationship when it is frayed, when it is broken, and teachers need to lead that. So those are the kind of things I think a lot of schools and a lot of school networks are thinking about. I think a key piece on that too would be the more that you can attempt to create a school system where you're mainstreaming students of all types. So there is a comfort and an understanding that who we are as a community includes a wide variety of people with different skills and strengths and who are bringing different things to the table. Your classroom environment is going to be a lot stronger. But a lot of schools don't necessarily go that route. There's still a lot of pulling out of students for services that might be better done within a given classroom. So those are the kind of things I'd love to see change.
Okay. Well, I know we are out of time and you have to go. So I want to be very respectful of that. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to interview you and showcase you. I would love to continue this conversation in another episode at another time. So thank you so much for that, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye.